This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not an offer or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell securities. SNN Network, SNN Inc., and the Planet Microcap Podcast and the representatives are not licensed brokers, broker-dealers, market makers, investment bankers, investment advisors, analysts, or underwriters. We do not recommend any companies discussed. We may buy and sell securities in any company mentioned and may profit in the event those securities rise in value. We recommend you consult with a professional investment advisor, broker, or legal counsel before purchasing or selling any securities referenced in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft. Thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in. Do me a quick favor. If you like what you hear at Planet Microcap, please take 2 seconds and give us 5 stars on Spotify or Apple. This helps with the search engines so that more folks can also discover and engage with all things microcap stocks. My guest on the show today is Chris Abbott, CIO of 1035 Capital Management. As it states on the 1035 Capital Management website, and I quote here, our passion is to uncover these opportunities. By opportunities, he means companies undergoing fundamental business improvements that should drive future stock returns before the ramifications of a positive catalyst become evident to the majority of investors, a concept we call front-running the black box. This quote encapsulates everything we talk about today. The idea of eclectic value, intelligent diversification, microcap turnarounds, and we dive into a few stocks that exemplify some of these themes, as well as Chris's small cap core investment strategy. Thank you again for tuning into the Planet Microcap Podcast, and please enjoy my conversation with Chris Abbott. Chris, thank you for joining me today. How you doing, man?
Doing well. Thank you for inviting me, Bob. I appreciate the access to your audience.
Absolutely. No, it's my pleasure. You know, look, we've been following each other for a while. Mm-hmm. Here we are playing in the same microcap circles. You know what? It's time to jam on some fun microcap everything at this
point. That's my favorite thing to do. So that'll be great.
Heck yeah. So before we get started, get into all that, you know, for those, I think you did one podcast before this, you know, for those that maybe didn't hear that or don't know your background or anything, you know, how'd you land at 1035 and how'd you get to where you are in terms of focus on long only specializing in small microcap companies?
Well, we could do quite the story on that. But short version is my brother started investing early. I'm from Vancouver originally, which, you know, a microcap investor should know is the home of the TSXV. So my brother started investing really early. And his friend gave him a tip on a gold miner and I bought it. And then it didn't work out very well. But that being said, I was hooked. And it became a question of like, well, how are other people making money when I lost money? What did I do wrong? And I'm kind of the guy that loves a challenge. And I embarked then on really a lifelong quest of how do I make money in the stock market? That then led to, I got an ice hockey scholarship as a good Canadian and went to a school in St. Louis, Missouri, where I still am. And from there, I did a finance and economics undergrad, then a master's. And during my master's, I was able to land an internship with a company called Argent Capital. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time because there was a lot of turmoil at that point. And there was a lot of turnover on their small cap team where I was the intern. So in a couple of years, I went from intern to helping manage that portfolio. Never got the portfolio manager title, but I was running about half that fund. So that was just an unbelievable experience where I was able to learn, as my old boss would say, from a fire hose. So it really took me from I'm interested in investing and how do I learn how to do this to here's the fundamental tenets of what makes a good company and what makes a bad company. What are the things to look for changes in stock price? And how do you understand what's priced into the stock today? Because I think that's really something that a lot of investors have a hard time with, especially newer investors, is the differentiation between a good company and a good stock to invest in.
Well, I mean, it's so hard to tell, like, all right, you know, because you're now pulling in an arbitrary qualitative, you know, idea or basically a qualitative idea and saying, oh, this is what's being priced in the stock at this point, right? You know, that is extremely difficult. Like me and you could BS all day about what we think it might be, but what it actually is, we might be completely off.
I'll say this. You may or may not know about this, but I think a lot of people in asset management would be familiar with Credit Suisse Holt. Have you ever heard of that? Mm-hmm. Well, the H in that was a gentleman named Bob Hendricks. Bob was a mentor of mine. And one of the things that Credit Suisse Holt is great at is giving you the implied valuation of the market, right? It's one of its great skill sets, I think. What Bob used to always say to us is our group at Argent was, quote, one of his power users, and his power users used like 90% of the access onto the platform, and then everyone else did 10%. So I think a lot of people have exposure to Holt. I think Bob would say a lot of people don't use Holt correctly. So whether or not I use it correctly, you know, I'll let Bob be the judge of that. He's no longer with us, so he'll definitely know I just said that. but yeah, that's definitely the foundation of how I think about what's priced in comes through Holt.
Absolutely. So, you know, one more thing I wanted to ask you before we dig into a couple other microcap-y ideas, because I want to talk microcap turnarounds, you know, just a whole host of other things, you know, but before we get there, you know, I want to better understand also, you know, what your investable universe looks like. You know, I know you have a strategy that you describe as small cap core. So love to hear a little bit more about your investable universe and how you define this strategy, small cap core.
So small cap is a funny one because everyone kind of looks at it differently. The way I look at it is the top decile of the Russell 2000 and below. So whatever's below that. Now, it doesn't have to be in the Russell 2000. I don't limit myself to the index. But from a market cap perspective, top decile of the Russell 2000 and below, that's a changing target. You know, sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower. But as a rough number, I usually think about like 5 billion or less is kind of where I start. I gravitate more to the billion or less. That's more my type of company. I think there's a lot more opportunities. There's less people that follow and really try to dig into those businesses. And that's what I like to do is really try to understand the businesses I'm buying. I guess I'm the old school shareholder that thinks I'm actually an owner of this company.
Very cool. So, I mean, we were talking offline and when you were describing the small cap core, you were basically saying it's where eclectic value meets disruptive growth and you get this. So can you describe each of those various factors and then how you marry them together to create small cap core?
Yeah. Sorry, I missed your question there. Small cap core. So the way I do it is we have eclectic value where I'm looking for really unique value situations. If you go listen to the Value Hive podcast, you'll hear a few of those. And then the other side is disruptive growth. So I take those together, I mix them together, and I have a portfolio that has better than Russell 2000 valuation with better than Russell 2000 growth, which if you look at the S&P style boxes, that puts you in either core or sometimes they call it balanced. But the idea is really to get the best of both worlds, some value exposure plus some growth exposure.
Very cool. I mean, so give us a, if you may, you know, I know you mentioned a few examples on the other one, you know, but give us a, maybe an anecdote or an example of one that kind of fits that criteria. Maybe it's a current holding or maybe one that you already sold, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, people like examples. I like examples, you know,
everyone loves an example. Yeah. I'll give you an example. So this one's been killing me. And we did talk a little bit about it on, I think the Value Hive podcast, but it's gotten a lot cheaper since then. So I'll mention it again, is Vertex Energy. So it's been an absolute disaster. Now it was an interesting situation and I actually wrote a Seeking Alpha on it years ago. And you know, I originally bought that thing in the like ones and it ran up to like 15, 16. I sold a lot of it in the teens, like kind of 12, 13 range. And then I got sucked back in and when it fell to like the nines and eights, and then I really started buying it in the fives and below, and then really started pressing the gas as it's recently fallen in 2024. So that's the type of name that I'm looking for where I think there's an obvious value event coming, right? So you've got this company, it's got all these different assets. It's very difficult to recreate a refinery, and I dare say near impossible in the US in this environment. Even if you could, it's gonna cost you a couple billion dollars. We've got a company that's got about $250 million in debt. They've also got a $100 million inventory financing agreement on top of that. And then they've got a standalone refinery that they've then added on a renewable diesel project to, as well as another refinery and a used motor oil collection business. So if you go through the pieces of this business, it's quite clear that the valuation is much higher than the market gives it credit for. The main diesel refinery, the Mobile plant, is insured for more than $1 billion. The market cap is like 100 million. The enterprise value is like 300 maybe. So that one asset, the insurance company says, is worth at least $1 billion. They're also working on a JV through Bank of America. They've pointed often to the Colomat deal that was done a couple of years ago, also run with Bank of America. And if you start to run the numbers on what Colomat was paid on a price per barrel versus the amount of barrels that Vertex has, you easily get into the $750 billion valuation for a JV. So you've got two different billion-dollar pieces on a company that's trading at less than $500 million EV. So the case here is, okay, they've been burning cash as they put together this renewable diesel part of the business. That is true. And certainly the renewable diesel economics haven't been great this year. I think the real story starts in 2025, though. But I think the real key is we're 6 months or less away from the announcement of a JV that I think brings in $200 to $300 million. And from there, they pay back what they have, which is pretty pernicious debt that they took on before they basically, as they bought this refinery, which was a big coup for them a couple of years ago. So they need to refinance that debt. It yields about 17%. They'll bring in $200-300 million in cash. Yeah, they'll keep some debt on the balance sheet, but it will really take it down. That alone should save them $20-30 million in interest, puts them into easily positive earnings. And then at the same time, frankly, crack spreads are doing quite well right now. So we'll see how long that lasts. That's a traditional, another driver for their diesel business. So here's a company that trades at a significant valuation to its discount to its assets. Talked about it before, but I think I said on the Value Hive podcast, you could go down and burn down the refinery. I don't suggest anyone does it, but go burn down the refinery in Louisiana and, you know, it's worth $1 billion. That's 3, 4, 5 times what it's worth today. So don't go do it. I'm not condoning that, but there's so much value in those assets. They're almost, I'm not going to say irreplaceable, but they're very hard to recreate in this world, especially in North America.
And I mean, in your opinion, what's the percentage of risk that the company goes defunct before any of these catalysts take hold?
I'm not going to say it's zero, but it's very close to zero, I think. Because worst case scenario, I think people forget this. They also have, so when they bought the Mobile facility, they tried to sell both of their used motor oil business and the refineries associated with that. They sold the smaller one. That original deal didn't go through. It was to Safety Clean. They pulled that and then sold the smaller of the refineries on its own for, I believe it was $90 million. Okay, so the other refinery is worth at least $90 million, maybe $150 million plus the UMO business. There's definite interest in that asset. Now that it's not all together, could Safety Clean come back in? Maybe, but there's definitely other interest in that asset. So worst case scenario, they sell this. They still want it because there's some use for it in their new business plan. But if they had to, I think they could peel that off relatively quickly. Now, I really don't think that'll be the issue, especially if crack spreads stay in the $30 range, because they're going to be making money now, and then it's not a cash burn problem. And I do expect that they'll get a JV done. To me, the big question is it, do they give up 25%, 40%, 30%? What's the number that they give up to get $200 to $300 million that then gets them out of their capital problem? And in fact, on the last call, the CEO specifically said, our intent in this JV is to replace the capital we invested into the renewable diesel refiner, which is about $260 million, back on the balance sheet. So we know what he's looking for, $250-ish million. And he said that they expect to have a deal to announce in Q2. So we should be months away.
Very good. All right. And just for full clarification, I know you more or
less. Oh, and yes, I do own it.
I'm going to make t-shirts one of these days, like for full disclosure. Do you
own for full disclosure, I do own this. Yes. You asked me to do that and I forgot.
No, you did. You said bought it this and then we rebought it that. So you did good.
I implied it, I guess. Yeah. So that would be a good example of the value side for me. Okay. Another one that I've talked a couple times about on my Twitter, and I always intended to write an article, but just haven't gotten to it, frankly, is a company called ASP Isotopes. So ASPI, ticker symbol, do own it. It's become a big position for us because it's done quite well. But basically, they're a really neat business. They basically have two sides of the business. They have medical isotopes, and then they've got a JV that does quantum laser enrichment for uranium. Okay. And the specific end market for that is something called HALEU, which is high assay, low enrichment uranium. And that goes into next generation uranium reactors, specifically the small nuclear modular reactor. Okay. So why is this business interesting to me? This little South African business at that. So what I learned in looking into this business is, to the best of my knowledge, only two countries never signed on to the nuclear proliferation agreement, Saudi Arabia and South Africa. And South Africa had a very strong nuclear research team during the apartheid days. When apartheid ended, that program ended, and those scientists had to go figure something else out. And what they did is they created this technology to do QLE, quantum laser enrichment, but also a new methodology to separate isotopes. Okay. And this new methodology to separate isotopes is effectively cheaper, faster, better, right? Like, cut to the chase, that's the idea of it. And where this becomes really interesting is in medical isotopes. So think like, I can't name it, but ytterbium, I think is what it's called. I might be wrong on the name, I apologize. But there's all sorts of different radioactive medical isotopes, most of which come out of heavy reactors, most of which come out of Russia. Okay, obviously dealing with Russia right now is a no-go. So there's been a massive deficit in supply for these guys. ASP is ramping into that market. And then there's a bunch of other non-medical isotopes, things like specialized silicon that go into quantum chips, et cetera, on that business. So that's a really interesting business. They've got their first sales starting in Q1, and it's ramping aggressively. I think they probably do maybe 10 million, 12 million in sales this year on that business. So that's kind of interesting. And it's like high margins, 80% plus. But the really attractive part here is this QLE. And to the best of my knowledge, there's only really one competitor. It's a company called Silex in Australia. So market cap on Silex is like 800 million plus. They've got a partnership with Cameco. And just the other day, actually, the CFO of Cameco came out and said, I'm going to paraphrase what he said, but Silex is years away from being able to make HALEU. Okay. Whereas ASPI is out there and has already signed two MOUs with two of the largest SMR reactors. I believe one of them is TerraPower. I don't know who the second is. So we're talking about Bill Gates's power company. And then another of the major players. Those companies have indicated a demand of $30 billion in HALEU between 2027 and 2037. Okay. And there is no other really Western supplier. There's one other Western supplier other than Silex, but it uses an old process, not very efficient. But here's where it gets really interesting is QLE has figured out a way, and no one else can do this, to take nuclear tailings and enrich them into HALEU in one pass. Silex can use tailings, but they have to do it in 3 to 4 passes. So one of the issues with this technology is obviously it takes a lot of energy, costs a lot of money to run these things. So you can imagine running it once versus 3 or 4 times is very beneficial to your margins. And then even more than that, effectively they can set up a tolling model, because there's a lot of places that have nuclear waste that want to get rid of it. Well, what better way than you pay someone to get rid of it, ASP, and then they turn around and re-refine it, turn it into a value-added product that gets used to turn around and create energy for people. So QLE is a really interesting JV. They just raised like $25 million in a convertible note through some really well-informed uranium investors in Europe. Tees River coming to mind. They've also done an investment in ASPI. But what I think is just the bee's knees for ASPI is they set up this QLE joint venture. They're going to get a 10% royalty on everything, all the sales that QLE ever does into perpetuity. Plus they get a E&P contract on the building of all their plants. So you got, they just raised $25 million. That's going to plants. So that's going to run through ASP. You get a 25-30% margin on it. So the stock's done really well. I think the market cap is now around $250 million. They've already got revenue. They'll have cash flow this year. The closest competitor is Silex, which is just the QLE JV that ASPI owns 100% of. Now they're going to sell some off. You're talking about 3.5 times valuation disparity between the two. So there's a little bit more to it than that, but that's the high level. And that would be in my world of disruptive growth.
All right. So next topic I want to get to, and I appreciate you sharing both of those, but you know, I only got so much time with you, so I want to cover a whole bunch of things.
Absolutely.
And just being totally fair, everything about isotopes and all that, like that is right over my head. But I'll, you know what? I'll invite the company on at some point. We'll do a long form interview and we'll,
Paul Mann is, he's really good. He should have.
Yeah. I think that'd be really fun. So, you know, one thing we were jamming on actually right before we jumped on to record here was, you know, 2023, everybody can see, you know, it was a rough year for many microcap investors, and they're specifically, if you kind of were looking at the turnarounds, if your thesis was 2023, okay, this is going to be the year that a lot, maybe companies that struggled coming out of COVID, you know, okay, they had some excuses, 21, 22, okay. Maybe they raised a little bit of capital, they're cashed up. All right. 2023 might be the year that they're going to now, you know, hit the ground running. Everything is locked in, you know, supply chain's good, all this other stuff, they're good to go. But as a result, let's say 2023 ended up not being the year that some of those companies expected. And so now they're in a quote unquote turnaround phase. You know, maybe they decide to do that in the second half of the year or whatever. Maybe the first half of 2024, they're now saying, oh, we're, you know, going to be doing a couple things to run the company more efficiently. So in your opinion, why do you think 2023 was a rough year for maybe some of these turnaround stories? And is 2024 looking any different?
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious the issue is interest rates. It's interest rates. It's cost of capital and the derivative of that, which is then access to capital. And, you know, one of the things, I also had a very rough 2023. It wasn't a good year for me. It certainly didn't go the way I wanted it to. One of the things I focused on was alternative access to capital, and even that didn't help. Even if you had a different way to raise capital than going out and borrowing money or selling equity, didn't matter. The environment in microcap, and especially microcap turnarounds, was a show me story. Prove to me that you're not going bankrupt. And until you prove that to me, you're going bankrupt. and it's as simple as that. And I'm going to trade you as such. So, I mean, I think that's what happened in 2023. I think the key to see that change is this slowing in the rate of interest rate increases. Obviously, there's everyone out there, we're talking about three cuts, the Fed yesterday, three cuts. You don't necessarily need three cuts, I don't think. And in fact, I don't think you even need one cut per se for small cap to do better. I think what you need to do is have small cap businesses have an understanding of their access to capital. And for banks to lend and other lenders to lend, they need to understand what the risks are and what the cost of money is. So when you're changing cost of money so rapidly, like what happened in 2023, it really causes people to pull back on their risk appetite. And let's be fair, you know, there's extra risks that come with micro and small cap, and access to capital is one of them. And I think that's exactly why they got punished, especially if you were perceived as a company that needed capital.
Absolutely. I mean, even from a fundamentals perspective, some of these companies, I mean, did you see a little bit of that as well? You know, that was kind of one of my theses, like trying to take a step back from just interest rates being kind of, because that's like a given, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but even just from a fundamental performance and executing the business model perspective, it seemed like that also was a very, you know, it was, for lack of a better term, it was just difficult.
My one pushback would be that's always the case. You got to execute, especially in small and micro. You always have to execute. If you don't execute, you're in trouble. One of the things I often say is in small and micro, you're almost always betting on the horse, right? Or sorry, on the jockey, not the horse, right? Like you want a good horse, but you want the jockey. But you need good management. Right? If you don't have management that can execute, then it doesn't matter how great the idea is, right? Or how good the business is. Someone can come along bigger and better, stronger, more well-capitalized. So you need to be able to execute on your opportunities. So I guess I'm always disappointed in small cap execution and micro cap execution. I think that's just, you know, that's par for the course.
It's a good expectation to set for yourself.
Yeah, it's never quite as easy as everyone hopes, right?
Yeah,
so right. I would say 2023 was definitely a difficult year for execution. And there was exogenous factors that caused that. You know, some hangover on supply chains for some businesses. Although I think that's an excuse. I think that's an excuse for poor execution. So I really do think you look at some companies that executed extremely well in the last year, and their share prices did do well. So Now, I do have an example of another company. It's called LifeMed. It was one that definitely everyone thought was going to go bankrupt. And as soon as they proved that they weren't going to go bankrupt, the stock took off. So when it became obvious that, no, actually, you're not going to go bankrupt, the stock went from like $2. I think it hit 11 today, maybe 12. Just now, not for fun, but
for full disclosure.
Oh, I do own it for full disclosure.
Okay. All right,
so another name, you know, they also are benefiting from the GLP-1 tailwind. So certainly some of that 2 to 12 is that. But even before that became the big driver, the stock started going up once people became confident that it wasn't going away.
Absolutely. I mean, do you feel, it seems like there's two things happening, you know, the ones that had some sort of direction for where they now want to go in order to execute, you know, either a new business model or maybe selling off a couple assets and then revamping their entire corporate structure, all that kind of stuff. You know, you're seeing some of that. You're seeing some companies that their stocks were just so depressed, but yet the business itself was still a decent business and they're just getting scooped up, you know, private equity, you know, smart money is going to be smart money, right?
Like right. Just, opportunity abounds.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I've been seeing a little bit here is that there's been more of these either just turnarounds. There's also been just companies saying, you know, we'll take the check. We're done being a microcap, man. This is tough. so I mean, that's some of the stuff I've seen already. And I mean, we're 3.5 months in or 2.5 months already into 2024, but those are a couple of trends, at least on that perspective that I've been seeing so far.
Well, I think they go hand in hand, right? When you're in a,
yeah, totally.
Let's call it a bear market, right? Yeah. There's a lot of people that are like, oh, how am I going to get the next 10, 15, 20 million I need to keep this company going? And then someone comes along and says, oh, I'll pick you up for a 60% premium. Yeah, sure. Let's do it. Why not? And you know, I like to think that everyone that owns stocks thinks about it long-term like I do. I know that's not true, not even close. There's probably more that don't. So a lot of these people are in it for, you know, 50%, 60%, and that's fine. You know, that's what makes a market. There's lots of people that trade. We can all do our own thing. So I think it's a time frame perspective and what are you looking for? If you're looking for 50 or 60% in 6 months, then you're happier for that buyout, right?
Yep, 100%. So anything we're missing on this front? I mean,
I'm sure there's tons that we're missing. If I knew it all, I would have had a better year. That's for sure. So there's definitely tons I'm missing. I know that for a fact. But you know what? I also will say, you know, been doing this for 15 years on the buy side now. I have noticed that every strategy, every style, every type of company goes in and out of favor.
Yeah,
so totally. There will be a time that microcap is the worst thing in the world. And I think we lived that in the last, you know, 12 to 18 months, maybe a little more than that. But there will be a time that you can't get enough microcap. And you know, frankly, that was 2020, 2021, and it'll happen again. So, I mean, it's a cycle. My goal is always do better on the upside and do less bad on the downside, right? That's how I try to think about it. But I know that the cycle's coming. Be careful when you have people that aren't stock types telling you picks. That was the top for me when I had friends of mine coming up to me that never talked to me about stocks and they start telling me which stocks to buy. And I'm like, oh boy, we're in trouble.
Or Brady, yeah, what crypto to buy.
That's a totally different.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I did think of one more question with turnarounds and then we'll move on to another topic. Sure. You know, in your opinion, what does a quality microcap turnaround look like to you? You know, what I guess in essence, I'm asking which of the ones have the lead, you know, what hair can you tolerate?
I think I might be a bad person to ask that because I can tolerate a lot of hair.
Exactly. No, that's why you're been, perfect.
Yeah, I've definitely been willing to overlook certain things. To my detriment, another one that I talked about on Value Hive was Chicken Soup for the Soul. And full disclosure, I owned it at the time. I no longer own it. And I can tell you why. Long story short, I was on a doom scrolling on Twitter and or X now. And I saw someone that had said, you know, I'm a creator and I'm suing Chicken Soup for the Soul because they haven't paid, basically. I'm paraphrasing, but that was the gist of it. Started looking into it, found more and more people that were saying basically similar things. And then I found a article that said, hey, Barbie's like the number one rented movie for like the eighth week in a row. And if you read into the article, it was like, but it might be because the biggest renter, Redbox, hasn't updated their DVDs in the last month. And I'm like, oh, that's a problem, right? So in the case of Chicken Soup for the Soul, the theory is, hey, you've got assets there. I thought that they would be able to use those assets to access capital because they're in a liquidity crunch. I think the business is worth a lot more than where it's trading, but they need liquidity to get from here to there. And specifically here to there is stable return to movies at Redbox. They ran out of liquidity and now they can't buy the movies for Redbox. That obviously turns you into a much bigger liquidity problem, right? And that's why I ultimately moved on from that when I learned about that. So one thing that I think you have to be super careful about and comes from that experience is you've really got to watch out for debt with liquidity problems, right? Like, be very careful of a highly leveraged company that needs liquidity. Those are tough. I wouldn't consider those quality turnarounds. And in some cases, maybe there's other things there, but I really would suggest being cautious there. However, what makes a quality turnaround? Really what I'm looking for is someone that has simple access to self-help, right? I don't necessarily want you to be over-leveraged, but if you have a little bit of leverage and you can improve your margins significantly, or there's something you can do to really improve your sales, I'm okay with your leverage as long as you can self-help yourself. I'll reference my old mentor, Bob Hendricks, and Holt again. I one time asked him, I said, hey, what's the most valuable metric in all of Holt? And he answered in 1 second, he said, change. And I look at the world that way. It's not what you did last year. It's what you do next year and the year after and the year after. And if you can actually change your cash flows by better sales, better margins, or better asset efficiency, your stock price should fall. So the thing that I always look for is I want to make sure that the business, the fundamental business, is getting better. And I try to pay less attention to the stock. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that you aren't going through necessarily a poor time like in Vertex. Like, it's definitely not a good year to be a renewable diesel refiner. But I do think you will ultimately be in a position where that's going to be a good business. It's going to make a lot of money for them. And I think that they can improve the traditional refinery at the same time. Plus, they've got non-traditional sources of capital. So I'm quite happy to wait as long as they keep building the business in the right way for long-term value. Now, does that hurt quarter to quarter? Yeah, sometimes it definitely can. Definitely can. But welcome to the world of turnarounds. It's rarely a straight lineup. But when you get them right, they can be fantastic. And we talked about it offline. I don't own it, but I used to once upon a time. Joint. You know, I bought that as a turnaround in the low single digits and brought it all the way up to 100 plus. So when you get a turnaround right, that's why you do it.
Without question. And I think that's a great place to put a ribbon on microcap turnarounds. I'm sure you're going to come back. I'm sure at some point we'll talk more about it, because I think there's so many right now that, like, I mean, I talk to issuers all the time and, you know, we talk about their narrative and where they're at in their business cycle. And they're like, oh, we're in a turnaround phrase. And you're just kind of looking at the stock chart like, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I see that.
Go figure.
This is a transition year. I love that.
Yeah, it's a transition year. And look, we joke right now, it's tough running a business. We're not, I don't want to make light of anything, you know, like,
things do happen that you don't expect.
Exactly. You know, so I joke, we're kibitzing and making little jokes here, but you know, we do recognize that it's very difficult to run a business, and especially being a public microcap. I think, you know, most of these CEOs, that's, you're wearing two hats and they're both extremely difficult jobs. Especially if you're coming from large cap. I mean,
or worse still, I think private. I mean, just because it's just such, the expectations are so much higher on us small cap, micro cap, public CEO than an equivalently sized private company.
Yeah. I do think the valuations are getting a little bit better for if companies were looking at going public a little earlier in their life cycle. I think valuations are it's starting to kind of condense where that PE money is just not the same, or the valuations are just not the same, where there's a lot of interesting opportunities for these companies right now that are re-recognizing again that, you know, being a public company earlier in their life cycle gives them much more access to capital, just all the main benefits of being a public company. Mm-hmm. You know, that I'm starting to kind of see that a little bit more. It seems like the IPO market is starting to heat up. I mean, you know, talking to a lot of private companies recently. So
I would agree with you that I'm seeing more access to capital for private companies right now. I'm seeing a little more interest in going public. But I wouldn't say it's tipped entirely yet.
Not tipped entirely. It's more like to go public in order to raise. All right, fine. We'll go public just to raise that growth capital.
Yeah.
Don't think about volumes right now. like it's just to go public just to get that initial rate, you know, that, you know, 10, 15, 20 million, whatever it is, you know, from the IPO proceeds. And then you're like, all right, we did that just to get that. And now we're public, I guess.
I guess I'd rather see that than the SPAC model, where you think you're going to end up with a bunch of money and then everyone redeems and you went public. So you got the worst of it, which was all the regulatory headaches and the burden, and you also didn't get the cash. 100%. And now your stock has fallen 90% and you can't raise capital either. Yeah, so I would rather the traditional IPO route for most companies.
Me too, that, without question. Even though, I mean, there are some people who put together some de-SPAC strategies that have been kind of interesting.
But, yeah, absolutely. I've actually had a few de-SPACs that worked, but it was prior to this recent bubble.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So one other topic I wanted to talk to you about that you mentioned on your website and your letters is intelligent diversification. You know, this is a tangent from, you know, what diversification that everybody likes to quote from, you know, the greats and whatnot. So in your opinion, what do you mean by this phrase?
Well, honestly, it's kind of the same thing, right? What I'm looking at is I want to take diversification as much as I can that benefits me, but I don't want to keep adding names. I'm a firm believer that there's only so many what I'll call A ideas. There's only so many B ideas. There's a bunch of C's and a bunch of D's and a bunch of don't even touch them, right? And to the point of diversification, I think that's a real thing. So my goal is trying to figure out that balance between how much diversification is enough diversification, how much is too bad. But you also have to pay attention to what the bets are you're making. And I think this is like where people get a little too simplistic with it is, oh, I've got 35 names or whatever it is. I need 35 names. And I like 30 numbers. That, you know, that's a good starting point for thinking about diversification, 30 names. And there's lots of academic studies for why that makes sense, but don't need to go into that here. However, what I think people miss a lot of the time, especially more retail, less experienced investors, is you might have 20 or 30 names, but they're all playing the same theme, or they're all basically moving on the same action. So like an easy example of it is you own NVIDIA, AMD, SMCI, pick a few others that are all part of the AI revolution, right? You could have 5, 6, 10 names in AI, but you're exposed to one theme. You've got no diversification at all, despite being spread across many names. All you've done is you've taken out the company specific risk. However, you've ramped up the industry or, you know, the theme specific risk in this case. So for me, it's a balance between, I want to have at least 10 or 30 names. That's just kind of the starting thought process, but 30 names isn't all of it. It's also, how do I look at these bets and which ones overlap and which ones offset each other?
Very cool. Yeah, no, I mean, it makes complete sense, you know, and I've always kind of thought about diversification in that sense as well, where, you know, on one hand it's, you know, you can own 3 to 4 that are all within the same sector, but, you know, let's say that sector has a major downturn. Listen, all of that's going to go to, you know, maybe some.
They're all going down. Yeah.
They're all going down, you know, but I mean, if you pick things that kind of offset each other in some respect, so that you're at least hedging your risk in some way, shape or form of like, okay, I have this thesis, but the counter to this thesis is this company that actually does not necessarily the opposite, but basically it counteracts whatever that company's trying to accomplish. You know, that's not a bad bet to also make for yourself too.
I can give you an example for you.
Let's hear it.
Yeah. So you might think that the economy is okay and Fed is going to lower interest rates. It's a great time to buy banks as a result because their margins will improve. And as long as the economy doesn't go to shit, they should be fine. That's the bank trade, right? There might be more nuance to it than that, but high level. So this is one of the things that, for what it's worth, full disclosure, didn't help me in 2023. So I went out, you buy some banks, and I also went out and I bought the people that benefit from rates continuing to rise. Like I owned a company that's called Rhythm, used to be called NRZ, New Residential, which came out of, I forget, it spun out of a big company in 2008-09. But basically, they own mortgage servicing rights, which is one of few financial assets that actually increase in value as interest rates go up. So you put a bank next to a mortgage servicing rights player.
What's the symbol on that?
RITM. It's a REIT. It's, you know, it's a weird little REIT for sure. But that's an example of how you can have two different positions. I can have my financial that benefits from lowering rates, and then I've got these guys that benefit from rising rates.
Very cool. I mean, is there anything in particular that we missed when it comes to intelligent diversity? I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory, you know, once we kind of dig into it a little bit, but
yeah,
I mean, any kind of nuance that like you've been able to glean from trying to put this into action over the last couple of years?
I think the biggest nuance is people miss their correlated bets.
I see.
Okay. I mean, you miss your correlated bets, and it's a good thing or a bad thing. It can be helpful if it's going in your favor, but it can be really bad if it's going against you. And you know, you mentioned buying all the stocks in a single theme, or, you know, I could buy 4 stocks in a single theme. It's definitely not something I'm afraid of doing. I'll do that. Sometimes it's very difficult to figure out which of the names is going to do the best. But they might all benefit from this theme. And as long as I'm out before the theme turns, I can play that. I'm fine with it. A great example of that was, you know, optical is like the ultimate boom bust business. So you've got like super short cycles, design cycles, 2-3 years. But when it's good, boy, is it good. And then it gets real bad real fast. So if you can time those cycles, there used to be like 7 or 8 players. You could buy them all at the same time and they'd all double or triple. Now it's down to like 4 or 5, and less and less by the day, it seems, which is good for the industry. They need consolidation to cause a lot of their problems, but or lack of consolidation caused a lot of their problems. So, you know, good for the industry, but there's absolutely an example of like, you could go and buy every stock in that industry. It's hard to say whether 100G NRZ or 100G, you know, whatever other type of pluggable being put in is going to be the winner, but you know that it's going to be a good market, so you can buy them all. You just got to be quick to get the heck out.
Yeah, 100%. Dude, we covered everything that I was hoping to talk about here today. I mean, so Great. Let's get to final thoughts. I mean, thoughts on microcap turnarounds, any final things that folks you want to leave with the folks before our next chat?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing I would say is this is a fun industry. I used to tell my students, this is very fun. It's a good thing to do, but it's a lot of work. I think most people should realize that you're playing against other people that do this every day, all day. I've been doing it every day, all day for 15 years. I still have plenty of room to improve, to be fair. And there's people way better than. So it's one of the only industries in the world where people walk up to it and they say, I've never done this before. Let me give it a shot. No one would ever say that about a brain surgery. I've never done a brain surgery before, but let me give it a shot. And I should make millions of dollars doing it. It doesn't work like that. This is a very, I guess you could get lucky, but typically doesn't work like that. But this is a very exciting business, and I love it because you'll never stop learning. I always learn little things about this company or this industry. We talked about isotopes. I didn't know anything about isotopes before I started reading into ASP. So I love the business. You can always learn, but it takes time, I think, to be good at it. And don't be afraid to put in the market tuition and the time, and it'll probably cost you a few lumps, but I think there's a lot of ways to make money in this business. You need to find the one that's right for you. But if you really like it, this is a great business. If you don't like it, though, man, this is torture.
As long as you're in it for the love of the game, you know, regardless of your performance, I think you'll do just fine, you know. But yeah, you're 100% right. So, Chris, that's a great place to end it. Where can my audience go and find more information on 1035 Capital Management, as well as to follow you on social media?
So we do kind of 3 things. I occasionally write articles on Seeking Alpha, thinking about potentially doing a Substack, but haven't got anything there.
Do it.
I might do it. I might do it. I actually had the Substack people called me the other day to ask. So I'm thinking about it. But
Linda's good people, man.
Linda, yeah, you know.
Yeah, she's good. She's good people.
Yeah, she was very kind. So there's that, Seeking Alpha, 1035 Capital. I've got a website, 1035capital.com. And then I also have Twitter, which is 1035_capital. Feel free to follow me, talk names. And I also put out some unique small cap, I'd call it quant data, just for fun, because it's kind of tough to come by. So if you like that kind of stuff, feel free to follow.
Very cool. And I forgot to ask about two names, Rhythm and Optical. Are you currently a shareholder?
Oh, so Rhythm, actually, I am. Good call. Yeah, full disclosure, I do own Rhythm. I think through my Optical, I don't own any Optical names right now. So.
Got it. Cool.
No exposure to Optical right now.
Very cool. All right, well, Chris, thank you so much for joining me today. Really do appreciate it. Good luck. Stay safe. And I really look forward to our next update.
Me too, Bobby. And next time I'm going to do a better job of full disclosures.
So you did fine. Later.
All right.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not an offer or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell securities. SNN Network, SNN Inc., and the Planet Microcap Podcast and the representatives are not licensed brokers, broker-dealers, market makers, investment bankers, investment advisors, analysts, or underwriters. We do not recommend any companies discussed. We may buy and sell securities in any company mentioned and may profit in the event those securities rise in value. We recommend you consult with a professional investment advisor, broker, or legal counsel before purchasing or selling any securities referenced in this podcast.